Go ahead.
All right. Our next speaker is Professor Stephen Pollack.
Okay. That'll be enough. First of all, let me thank Ilya and the Academy for inviting me, and I've been here several times now, and I'm afraid I'm speaking English. But what I'm going to do, which is something that I do very often when I speak, is to type some key concepts and things that I'm mentioning, so that if you want to bring them up, my understanding is we'll have a little bit of time for questions at the end, and you can ask about it. There's also this Russian text, which I can't really vouch for one way or another, but my argument will roughly follow what the text says. So first of all, what I want to do is to give you a sense of what the basic concept of the talk is in terms of, and it's reflected in the title of the talk, because I think these things will be relatively new. Not only to you guys, but also I think to the English speakers as well. And it has to do with developments that are taking place in science now and the way in which society's contract with science is being renegotiated. Okay? And so there are a couple of key terms that I introduce. One of them is the customization of science. And the other one is what I call prot science, okay? And both of these terms have fairly specific meanings. When I talk about customization of science, I'm actually drawing a distinction between the customer, right, and the consumer. In English, and I'm sure in other languages, this distinction often gets blurred. But I'm making a kind of important distinction here, which is one that you find actually in the marketing literature. And so the idea here being that the customer is someone who's interested in buying something, but not necessarily because they're going to use it. Okay? So this is the sense in which a customer can be someone other than a consumer. Okay? So if we talk about retail versus wholesale in business, right? The wholesaler produces things en masse, and the retailer buys from the wholesaler, but the retailer isn't necessarily using what is being bought. Okay, that's kind of where the distinction comes from initially. And what I'm arguing here is that we are actually living in a period where science is becoming customized in this sense. In other words, people are interested in purchasing science, learning about science, but not necessarily in using it or believing it in the way in which the scientists themselves put forward. Okay? And I think this is kind of a very important kind of distinction to make here. So one of the things that we find typically in the West when one does surveys of the public understanding of science is that more and more people are interested in science, and they will watch television programs and read popular books and all the rest of it. However, the more they find out about science, the more they actually disagree with what scientific authorities say. In other words, they take a rather independent line on science the more they find out about it. Okay? Now, this is a very unexpected finding, especially from the standpoint of the authorities in science. Okay? Because there's been this long-standing view among scientific elites, especially, that the more people learn about science, the more their opinions will be the same as the scientists. Okay? In other words, to be a customer for science is to be a consumer for science and to buy the stuff and to use it oneself. But this is not what's happening. People are developing very independent views about science, even as they find out more and more about it. Okay? And in the paper, I talk about many different controversies that have erupted in the Western world, and we can talk about, for example, the creationism-evolution controversy. We can talk about the climate change issues that are taking place now. We can talk about the debates over whether to use homeopathy and other alternative forms of medicine. All of these different ideas, one of the things that's very interesting about it is that the people who disagree with the scientific authorities often know quite a lot of science. Okay? I mean, one can argue about specific things, but these are not people who are ignorant or anti-science. They're, in a sense, people who, as it were, have reinterpreted the science for themselves. Okay? Now, this brings me then to prot science. Okay? And prot science is basically a contracted form of Protestant science. Okay? And in the history of Christianity, Protestantism, as you may know, was the moment in the history where the people took back religion for themselves. They no longer just trusted the priests. They no longer just said, well, you know, if it's in Latin, it's an authority, and I've just got to believe it mindlessly. No, people decided to read the Bible for themselves in a serious way and to interpret those results in ways that were directly relevant to their lives. This is what the Protestant Reformation was about. Prior to the Protestant Reformation, there was not a lot of Bible reading in Christianity. Christianity was about going to church, believing what the priest said, but there wasn't a lot of literacy, there wasn't a lot of reading for oneself. Okay? And so the Protestant Reformation actually is very closely connected historically with the rise of the printing press and the rise of literacy as a movement. Now, what I am, as you know also, right, one of the consequences of the Protestant Reformation, one of the things that came out of it, was the Scientific Revolution. Okay? And if you look at people like Francis Bacon, right, and even people who remained nominally Catholic, like Descartes and Galileo, right, all of these people were dissenting Christians. They were not Christians who, as it were, just listened to what the priest said, but interpreted the religion for themselves, and they found it empowering. Okay? Now, what I am arguing here is that a similar phenomenon is happening now, but within the realm of science. Okay? Whereas science, you might say, benefited from the Protestant Reformation in terms of becoming the new source of authority, that authority, the authority of science, is now being eroded by a movement that is very similar to what happened in the 16th and 17th centuries. And instead of the printing press, what one would point to here is something like the internet, and also the spread of mass education, and also the spread of popular journalism. All of these different ways of finding out about science makes people more informed, but also it empowers them to disagree with established authorities. And this is something that we are seeing increasingly and in a way that is unprecedented, actually. And so that a lot of movements that scientific authorities thought had been completely dead, like alternative medicine, like creationism, okay, they're back on the table. And they're back on the table in a more intelligent form, forcing the whole scientific debate to move to another level. And it's a level where there's going to be a lot of conflict, and it's not clear how it's going to be resolved. But this is the kind of world that we're moving into now, where people are feeling personally empowered by science. And one of the ways you can see this happening, right, is that people are beginning to take quite seriously an idea that was very strong in the Protestant Reformation, and that was, you live the faith. So what you believe isn't just an abstraction that you test, right, in some isolated setting like a laboratory, but what you believe is something you embody. It is who you are. And if it turns out that what you say, you know, what you believe is wrong, and you die, let's say, because you don't have adequate medical treatment or whatever, then you live with it. You're happy to do that. You want the choice. Okay? The choice is what matters. Okay? And I think this is a world, it seems to me, which, again, one of the consequences is if we take this world seriously, it opens up the sphere of risk. An enormous amount of risk gets opened up. And this is a problem that I don't think, you know, we have faced very squarely yet, but is one that I think is one of the consequences once people start, as it were, incorporating science into themselves, into their everyday lives, and then live accordingly. Okay? So this is a very interesting issue. Again, this is not a new issue. What's different is that in the scientific revolution, we talked a lot about testing beliefs, testing things, right? So experimentation of the sort of Francis Bacon happened in very selected, specialized settings. But now we're talking about people using their own lives as the test base for their beliefs, much more explicitly, okay? And I think there's an interesting sense in which this kind of development that I'm talking about here, this customization of science, it's a real test of what democracy means in a way, okay? If you go back to the 16th and 17th centuries, one of the things that you will see is that theologians and priests very often thought that if people try to interpret the Bible for themselves, they'll just be led to do all kinds of crazy things. And indeed, a lot of them did do a lot of crazy things, right? The history of Protestantism is a very mixed bag, okay? No doubt about it. But nevertheless, that is normally seen as a stepping stone in the direction of democracy. And what we are now is we're at a period where something similar may have to be said about science. That in a sense, people will be living with science in many different ways. Okay? And then we have to see what kind of a society do we have at the end where we allow this kind of diversity of interpretations of scientific views. And here it makes no sense to talk about anti-science. This has nothing to do with anti-science. This has to do with everybody taking science very seriously, taking it personally, as I put it in the paper, but nevertheless taking it in different directions. And this is the kind of issue that, in a sense, we're facing now. How much more time do I have?
15.
Is that correct? The chairs? I have 22 left? Okay. We'll go for 22. Okay. So I've made this initial distinction between the customer and the consumer for science. And I've talked about this idea of prot science. And I want to now get into a little more detail about how exactly does this happen. And I think the first thing is, you know, let's think about the internet for a moment. There are many ways of getting scientific information, not just by listening to scientific authorities, but by going on the internet. And the internet has information that is available to people who have different kinds of backgrounds, different levels of intelligence. So everyone can have a view about something, potentially. Okay? And what that means, all of that exposure of information at the same time opens up the sphere of accountability. Because then people can ask questions. People can wonder, is this really what you're saying? What does this mean? What is the evidence? And it is interesting how so much of the controversies that we see about science today have to do with issues of evidence. Right? Because people are operating on the assumption that they believe they are interpreting science the right way unless you show me evidence to the contrary. Why shouldn't I do this? What exactly is wrong with what I'm saying? In other words, you do not assume the authority is right. You assume you actually understand what's going on. And then you ask the other party to test your claim, to defeat your claim. This is how we get the controversies that we have in science today, very much in this fashion, where people are not taking authority for granted anymore. Authority has to be earned. A very important point. Now, as I also said, science, this is happening at lots of different levels. And so here I want to draw to your attention science journalism. People have many different attitudes towards science journalism, but certainly it is encouraging this trend that I'm talking about. And one of the ways in which it encourages this trend is by providing independent bases for analyzing and evaluating scientific opinion. And so, again, I realize this person may not be familiar to you, but in the United Kingdom, there is a journalist who is very much, he's in the Guardian newspaper. He's a trained medical scientist with a degree from Oxford. His name is Ben Goldacre. He's written a lot of popular books. He's a very interesting person in this discussion because this guy often presents himself, and he's not the only one, as defending science from itself. Okay? In other words, what he does is he takes scientific papers and he reanalyzes them. Right? So he looks to see whether the statistics are right. He looks to see whether data has been fudged or in some way distorted. And he also looks at who's funding the research to see if there's some motivation for the scientists not to be telling the truth. He claims to be speaking for science. He is not an academic, he is a journalist, but he is one with a PhD. He is trained, and he is an independent agent who puts himself forward as someone who is upholding the norms of science as they are normally understood. So he's not arguing for some creationism or alternative medicine or anything like that, but what he's showing is that what the scientists are doing on their own terms is false. Now you see, there's a lot of science journalism, which in a way is a kind of version of what, you know, is more familiar, investigative journalism, right? In politics, right? Politicians say all kinds of things, but then you have to analyze what they say, right? This is being extended to science. And the people who do investigative journalism are upholding the values of democracy, are upholding the same values that the politicians claim to be upholding, but are not. Okay? And this is what science journalism is doing. It's giving you this independent base. And as you may recall, from the Protestant Reformation, one of the problems with the church was corruption. Right? People trusted it, but did they have reason to trust it? Was it actually living up to its own standards? You see, this is a similar kind of development that we're seeing now happening in science, and this is among people who do not have kind of weird, new age, alternative views of things. These are people who believe in exactly the same norms. And it's this kind of process is part of what's going on here with the prot science. It's that too. And one shouldn't underestimate the significance of that in terms of undermining sort of the classical authorities of science. And of course, because Ben Goldacre writes in newspapers and writes in popular books, part of what he's telling you is that you too, if you spend enough time, can also analyze this stuff for yourself. Right? That's kind of part of the rhetoric of this. That you just need to be an intelligent, alert person, and you can do this yourself. So this is potentially incredibly controversial. Now, one of the things that I talk about in the paper is a recent episode where, in a sense, the kind of ambiguity, difficulties surrounding this kind of transition taking place in the public understanding of science caused enormous disaster. And so I talk about this earthquake in Italy, L'Aquila in Italy. I don't know if you recall it, this was in 2012, and this was an earthquake where something like 300 people died, 1,600 people were wounded, and 100,000 people had to leave their homes. Okay? Now the key thing about this earthquake was that the geologists and the seismologists, the people who were supposed to know about this stuff, basically publicly said, and had the support of the politician, that the probability of the earthquake was small, very small. Okay? Now, it is also clear, because there was a trial, and basically these scientists were put in jail for many years, until last week. Again, if you know about this story, you know last week this has been reversed. But I think the story itself is very interesting in terms of the difficulty, in terms of who takes responsibility for what. Who takes responsibility in science, okay? Because the argument that was accepted by the judge to convict the scientists was that the people trusted the scientists and the scientists misled them, okay? And the politicians, it's clear, wanted the science, or were inclined to think that a small probability meant less of a chance of the earthquake. They didn't want people to have a, you know, they didn't want people to get scared, or frightened, or anything, right? They wanted them to stay calm. So they were interested in the idea that people didn't think an earthquake was happening. But the point is, why should the scientists be the ones responsible? The scientists, as it were, did not say anything false from a strict standpoint, right? They actually gave accurate information. The public did not understand it, and the politicians didn't help matters. That's basically what the facts are of this case. Now, what this represents, it seems to me, is that we are in a kind of in-between zone. We are in a sort of middle position at the moment. Okay? We're in some sense, people still trust the scientists too much, but at the same time, they are not quite willing to know or to learn or to put in the effort to find out all they need to find out to be able to take full responsibility for themselves in terms of what they do, right? Because to be a true believer in prot science, you have to, as it were, look at the figures, look at the statistics, and then say at the end, yes, I'll stay in my home, or no, I will leave my home, and whatever happens in the world, I take responsibility. It is my fault, it was my decision. I am not going to blame some scientist for it. Okay, this is what prot science ultimately is about. And so what you could imagine in a situation like this earthquake situation is that different people would take different decisions. Some will stay, some will go, but nobody would sue the scientists. As long as the scientists represented the data accurately, it would be the responsibility of the people involved. That would be the ideal scenario as we move into a world of prot science. And in that case, then the scientists don't have to worry about this issue that I think hangs over the whole discussion, and that's paternalism, right? The idea that you really can't trust people knowing the facts because they're too stupid. And so what you have to do is you have to tell them something slightly different that gets them to do the right thing, even if that means that you have to corrupt the actual facts of the case. Paternalism. And this is the thing, this is the big enemy, it seems to me, from the standpoint of moving to prot science. Because at the end of the day, what you ideally want is you want the scientists to speak the truth as they see it. But you also want people to be free to make decisions based on their understanding of the truth. And that may go in different directions. And this is the kind of world, in a sense, that I think we're very gradually moving into. But I think that one of the consequences of this, and so in the final part of the full paper, I talk about the way scientists deal with this. Because in a sense, I think, the public is quite ready to embrace attitudes of democracy and freedom and all this kind of stuff, and they already are finding out more and more about science in a very willing way. But then I think the question is, what happens to science as an authority? That is the open question. How do scientists deal with this issue? How do scientists deal with this issue in a way that is not just reactionary and negative? Because as you know, there were lots of wars of religion in Europe in the 16th century. right? The church didn't go down easily. And so it seems to me this is the kind of problem that we face now, is how do the scientific authorities deal with what is effectively a very radical democratization of science taking place? Am I my time over, or do I? 10 minutes. My goodness. Well, I want to, there are two things that I want to bring up in the end here, okay, since I've got the 10 minutes. And it's about the way scientists have dealt with the various problems of their changing role in society, okay? For those of you who believe that scientists need in some way to reassert their authority in society, that in a sense these kinds of developments I'm talking about are in a way too radical, I recommend you a book. The Geek Manifesto. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's a British book. The guy who wrote the book, his name is Mark Henderson. Mark Henderson is a guy who's done a lot of public relations over the years He did public relations for the Royal Society, which is kind of the British Vatican of science, right? Also for the Wellcome Trust, which is kind of the main medical charity in the UK. So he sort of understands kind of the kinds of things I'm talking about, and he's frightened in a way and disturbed. And so what he is arguing is for a reassertion of scientific authority, but in what I would call, and again, I think for some of you old Marxists out there, you might appreciate this, petite bourgeois kind of way. If you understand something about the dynamics of this, in the world of science, there are, of course, the major players. They are the people who get the Nobel Prizes. They are the fellows of the Royal Society. They are the important people. They are the people who actually do the original research on which the basis of scientific authority comes. But then there's this whole other bunch of people, the people who apply that knowledge in various ways. And of course, in the recent times, in the period in which we live over the last 25 years, we've got this phenomenon of geeks. People who, for the most part, work as, let's say, laboratory technicians or, you know, IT people, right? These are people who have a kind of scientific background, and they identify very strongly with science, and they read a lot of science fiction, and they're very pro-science, and they very much identify with the more authoritative aspects of science. But they themselves have very little to do with the actual production of scientific knowledge. They're sort of in the bottom end of things. But they identify very strongly. And Henderson is appealing to those people. He is appealing to those people to be the ones who reassert the authority of science. And to basically put a kind of more up-to-date, modern face on paternalism. Okay? Where people believe what the scientists say. And if you follow a lot of the controversies that take place surrounding science, especially on the internet, you will see a lot of this phenomenon happening. It doesn't happen in academic journals very much, but it does happen on the internet a lot, and the internet is a lot of where intellectual stuff happens these days, in case you didn't know, okay? That, in fact, maybe most of the intellectual world happens on the internet these days. And it's here where these people are actually quite a strong voice, okay? And so I think that's a very interesting kind of a viewpoint. But the thing that is equally interesting about this is that these guys, these people behind the Geek Manifesto, they're just asserting the authority of science in a way for its own sake. In other words, because scientists say that there, you know, 95% of scientists believe global warming is happening so that the temperature of the Earth will rise 2 degrees centigrade in 50 years. You should therefore believe it. It's that straightforward. It's that dogmatic. Okay? It's not really about scientists, in some sense, leading people in a more enlightened, more empowered direction. Because I think this is one thing that separates the Geek Manifesto and the people who kind of buy into this idea from what we call the Enlightenment, the 18th century movement, which in a way was a secularization of the Protestant Reformation. Okay? In the Enlightenment was a very anti-authoritarian movement. And most of the people of the Enlightenment did not believe that science should become the new church. Okay? I mean, Auguste Comte did, but that's a little later. But in the Enlightenment, most of the people believed that, in fact, science was something for self and collective empowerment. Right? And that everyone should have access to that knowledge. And that it should not be a matter of replacing the Pope of religion with the Pope of science. Okay? And it seems to me that it's this kind of attitude that needs, that the scientific community needs to stand behind more directly, more explicitly. And so that, in fact, somebody like Ben Goldacre, the journalist who I mentioned earlier from The Guardian, is actually much more a person behind the Enlightenment, okay, than, in fact, somebody like Mark Henderson. And I think, you know, and I will close here, I think there's a sense in which we need to kind of get a sense of the two different ways in which the scientific community can think about its future in light of this customization and this general prot science. On the one hand, it may just try to reassert its authority and try to do it at a popular, maybe even populist level. And that's where Mark Henderson is coming from. But on the other hand, there may be an enlightenment moment for science here, where the fact that people no longer believe in the authority of science means that they actually take more responsibility for it, and they in fact use it as a kind of agent of empowerment, even though it can end up having very risky and even very damaging consequences. Because as you know, at the end of the Enlightenment, we got the French Revolution. Okay, so it's not that what I'm recommending here is some kind of pleasant future. But what I am recommending is one where science remains very central and important in people's lives and remains very self-empowering and not just becomes a new form of authority again as a result of reaction. And I'll stop here. Thank you.